This is an ABC podcast.
Hello from Marlo and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. It's Tuesday, September 2. I'm Kyle Evans filling in for Aggie Tupo, who's taking a little bit of R&R this week. Coming up today, debt fears in Vanuatu as a massive Chinese-funded road building program enters its third phase.
It is concerning. The risk levels are very high, especially if the country suffers another big economic shock.
Also, rising sea levels put nature's natural seawall, mangroves, at risk.
These are our three main values for the Pacific Islanders, which is coastal protection, the fisheries value, and also to protect boats.
And we hear from the crew behind Papabuka, Papua New Guinea's first ever submission to the Academy Awards. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. Firstly to Samoa, where official counting of votes began yesterday and will run for the rest of the week until official results are provided. Preliminary results from the snap election show that Lalui Latea-Schmidt of the FAST Party is leading with 31 seats, followed by the Human Rights Protection Party and Caretaker. Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa is trailing behind in fourth place with her Samoa Uniting Party. To discuss the preliminary results and how the new government is shaping up in Samoa, we're joined by Dr. Asanati Leakey, Senior Pacific Researcher with Sustaineo. Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat, Dr. Asanati.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, let's get right into it. As provisional results continue to come through, FAST Party have the majority of the seats with 31 so far. Are you surprised by that?
A bit surprised, actually, because I think both, especially HRPP and FAST, they did really, you know, great campaigns, roadshows and all that. So, but, you know, I was expecting a bit of a mixed results, but yeah, it is what it is.
Why do you think voters have decided to stick with FAST and rather than switch camps and go with FMA?
I think it's the way, the appeal of FAST, especially FAST Party, especially to, you know, the real needs of the people, especially also the support of the diaspora groups. So yeah, it's like, you know, with the social protection kind of promises that they gave, that was really, I think, appealing to the voters.
We heard yesterday, and I found this quite interesting, that the mood at the polls was somewhat somber. Do you think that might have impacted voter turnout at all, which you know, in effect might have impacted FMA's vote?
Yeah, I think so. It's, you know, I was in Samoa last week and it was like people were saying, let's get on with it. Enough of the noises and, you know, so much roadshow and promises being made and all that. And it has some kind of impact on that. Yeah,
look, I mean, obviously the last 6 months have been very tough for her. She's faced an internal power challenge and then her government was unable to pass the budget, which led to this snap election. Do you think she's being punished by voters or do you think this is just a symptom of, I suppose, fatigue of just the last half-year period?
Yeah, I think your line about punished by workers by voters, makes sense. Mind you, there's a whole lot of other issues surrounding her being leadership in the leadership role, and as well as her relationship with the Lauli Olemalietoa, chairman of the FAST Party. So yeah, there's a whole lot of other issues, and it's been brewing in the background in the last 6 months or something. And that has caused a lot of division as well among the voters.
Yeah. Now, FAST are obviously in the poll position at the moment. Do you think they're going to have the numbers to form a majority?
Yeah, good question. Let's let's wait and see. I think there'll be some court cases. HRPP leader has promised that he will make sure that justice is achieved and all that. I think it's there's a possibility there, but yeah, it's Not sure at the moment.
Well, if they don't, I mean, who do you think they'll buddy up with and form a coalition with?
Yeah, well, that'll be interesting because you've got some independents, I think 3 or 4 of them. That's a possibility they would partner with. But, yeah, we'll see. It's interesting because some of the independents themselves are former HRPP and, you know, members. So it's really not sure where their support will go.
The seats for the independents are quite surprising as well. 4 seats there. What does that mean for the political landscape of Samoa in terms of democracy?
You know, there used to be some a good, strong sort of independents in the past, and I see that coming back. And it's basically, I believe, it's a reflection of, you know, people just getting sick of parties, I guess, you know, or not trusting the parties to be part of. And it's something that's interesting because there was like, what, 50-something independent candidates that ran. Mm-hmm. So it's really speaking to, you know, the situation in Samoa political landscape that people are a bit more unsure of, you know, the parties and their role in politics, I guess.
Yeah, well, I guess 4 out of 50 doesn't sound like a whole lot, but is that a lot considering what we've seen in the past?
Yeah, quite a lot, I think. Usually they're part of smaller parties, but I think 4. It's quite an interesting one. I mean, last time there was one independent, and he was like the kingmaker sort of, you know, situation. But yeah, this time with 4, it's pretty good, I think.
And based on the preliminary results, the Human Rights Protection Party is likely to wind up as opposition. Do you think Tuia Lapela will accept another term from the opposition bench?
Well, he's already in. He's won his seat from his constituency, Lepa. He will, yeah. It would be interesting to see if there's internal, you know, his political party sort of reshuffling, whatever, in terms of leadership. But I suspect that that's what a lot of people might like to see. But, yeah, we'll see what happens.
And I guess with vote counting soon to be wrapped up by the end of the week, do you think that'll be the end of the political drama, or do you think it'll just be a sort of a plateau period before we get some more?
I think that there'll be a few court cases, but it shouldn't be as bad. You know, the situation shouldn't be as bad as, you know, it was in 2021. I think we'll be seeing a relatively sort of smooth transition to the new government in the next couple of months or so.
And what about Fia May? Does she have more to offer in the public eye? I mean, what do you expect out of her?
Well, you know, Fia May really represents to a lot of people the rule of law. Her adherence to that is very strong, has been very strong since she became Prime Minister. And that's very important. And I suspect that's what she will continue to stand for. Now she's in Parliament. She's been voted back in by her constituency. And I believe that that's what she's going to go for. It's just ensuring that, you know, members and the new government adheres to the rule of law.
Do you think this will be the last we hear of her in terms of, you know, making a run for the top job?
You know, she spoke about, you know, thinking about resigning before 2021. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that's, you know, if this would be her last term, decides to do other stuff. But, it'll be interesting, yeah.
Well, she could potentially do a lot of good, in a body like PIF or a UN body or somewhere like that. Would you like to see her, you know, maybe expand outside of Samoa and do something on the international stage?
Absolutely. She has a lot to offer to the region and, you know, the international community and, you know, in a lot of areas. I mean, climate change and gender equality, governance and, you know, lots of things that she's stood for. And I believe that she'll have do a great contribution for the region. Yeah.
Look, I certainly wouldn't bet against her. Look, that's all we've got time for this morning. But Dr. Asanahiti, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Very good. Thank you so much.
That was Senior Pacific Researcher based in Canberra, Dr. Asanati Leakey, speaking with us there.
Join Sosse Fomoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, people in Vanuatu are welcoming news that a big Chinese-funded road building program is going into a third phase. But there are also concerns the $70 million concessional loan that will pay for the works could worsen the country's risk of debt distress. Liam Fox reports.
On Tanna Island in Vanuatu South, Nancy Kauna says Chinese-built roads have made a big difference to people's lives.
The road that the Chinese already built is from the airport, and then they go down south to south of Tanna and then to the entrance of the volcano. It's really nice.
Nancy and her husband run Tanna Tours and Transfer Services. She says the road to the Mount Yasur volcano has made it a lot easier to transport tourists to the island's biggest attraction.
It's really good for the tourism. At the moment before that, we were struggling to go to the volcano, but now we can use buses today. And then we just organised the four-wheel drive to drive them to the top.
The road is one of several built around the country in recent years by Chinese companies paid for by concessional loans from the Chinese government. Last week, local media reported that a third phase of the project has been approved that will see another 24 kilometres of road paved on Tanna, as well as 15 kilometres on Umbai Island to the north. Nancy says it's good news.
It's good. Tanna is developing. We have better roads, but it runs up in the middle of the island. The ones that they're building now, the third phase, will be going through the central to North Tanna.
There's no question Vanuatu needs better roads. At the Pacific Infrastructure Conference in Brisbane last month, Vanuatu's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Finance and Economic Management, Johnny Koanapo, said transport is one of the government's priority areas for infrastructure projects.
Upgrading and climate-proofing critical transport links such as the airports, roads, bridges and wharves.
He also said the government was looking for innovative partnerships to fund infrastructure projects, such as what he called a build-operate-transfer model, particularly in the aviation sector.
Where the private sector can finance, design, construct and operate key aviation infrastructure for a defined period before transferring full ownership back to the government.
There's nothing innovative about the funding for the new roads, though. The money's coming the old-fashioned way, via a concessional loan, this one worth $70 million from the Export-Import Bank of China. That's risky, says Riley Duke, a research fellow at the Lowy Institute and co-author of its Pacific Aid Map.
Because of a few factors, you know, it is concerning. The risk levels are very high, especially if the country suffers another big economic shock.
He says the Vanuatu government had pledged to refrain from taking on more debt before the details of the latest loan became public.
It stated quite clearly in the 2025 budget that if it was upgraded to high risk of debt distress, that it wouldn't take on any more debt, even concessional debt, and it would rely just on grant financing for projects. So last year, it was upgraded to high risk of debt distress, but this loan has still gone ahead.
Debt distress is when a country is unable to fulfil its financial obligations and debt restructuring is required. It can lead to higher borrowing costs and harm growth and investment. Riley Duke says the latest loan increases the risk of debt distress.
I think it will. I mean, the balancing act for a country like Vanuatu is that it needs to find ways to finance its, you know, growth, and it does rely on external financing for these big projects. I guess the question is did this have to be done with a concessional loan? You know, in other parts of the Pacific, Fiji is a good example. There are major infrastructure projects that China is financing without it coming in the form of debt.
That was Riley Duke from the Lowy Institute, ending that report from Liam Fox. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kyle Evans filling in for Aggie Tupou this week. Busy show so far, in case you're just tuning in. La Louis Leatua Schmidt of the Fast Party is well and truly in pole position to become Samoa's next leader. Meanwhile, there's debt fears in Vanuatu as a massive Chinese-funded road building program enters its third phase.
It's stated quite clearly in the 2025 budget that if it was upgraded to high risk of debt distress, that it wouldn't take on any more debt, even concessional debt, and it would rely just on grant financing for projects. So last year, it was upgraded to high risk of debt distress, but this loan has still gone ahead.
Moving on now, and a special tree planting ceremony was held in Nuku'alofa last week to mark the start of Tonga hosting the Pacific Resilience Facility. The facility has been set up to administer climate financing from international donors to forum members. Pacific leaders are expected to sign the Pacific Resilience Facility Treaty when they meet next week in Honiara. Prime Minister and Forum Chair Asiaki Eki says getting the fund up and running is urgent, as Pacific nations don't have the luxury of time with climate change threatening their homes.
The goal is to raise $500 million, and that's why this mission is here in Tonga. We've already set aside space at the Prime Minister's office to begin housing the new facility, and we expect it to be fully operational by October.
Tonga's PM Asiaki Eki speaking there with some help from Finau Fanua of Pacific Beat. And the Prime Minister's office says the final legal preparations to get that facility up and running are currently underway. And speaking of climate, you might not realise, but mangroves are hugely significant as they protect swaths of low-lying land from erosion. However, rising sea levels and over-harvesting is alarming scientists who say many island mangroves are in danger of going extinct. As Finau Fanua reports, the loss of mangroves threatens the very sovereignty of island states as land loss forces people to move from their homes.
In Papua New Guinea, a local band performs a serenade about mangroves. It's a romantic song about a man who weaves mangrove seeds together as a necklace, a gift for a woman he hopes will one day become his wife. Apart from being prized as a source for traditional ornaments, mangroves play a vital role for communities across the Pacific. For time immemorial, the mass bundle of roots have served as a source of food, medicine, fuel, shelter, and even border protection.
These are our three main values for the Pacific Islanders, which is coastal protection, the fisheries value, and also to protect boats. And then there's the global importance of them as a carbon sink.
Since 1996, Fiji marine ecologist Helen Sykes has assisted communities in preserving mangroves. She says the plant plays a critical role for Fijian villages. In fact, the livelihoods and very existence of these communities are endangered without them.
When we have large cyclones or other large storm waves, if you have a decent thickness of mangroves along the coast, then the force of the waves is broken before it reaches the coast. It's also, for subsistence fishing communities, very important from a sense of being a nursery environment for small crabs, for shrimp, for a lot of juvenile fish that will eventually make it out to the reef when they get bigger. So they're very important to maintain the fisheries resources, many subsistence fishing communities who are dependent on being able to go out and catch fish both in and around the mangroves and on the reefs where those fish will eventually go out to.
The New Caledonian streaked fantail performs its own serenade from a tropical mangrove forest. The bird is endemic to New Caledonia, and the mangrove is its house, hospital, and cafeteria. It's where the bird lays its eggs. The mass of branches traps insects for the bird to eat and keeps it out of sight from predators. So how exactly does sea level rising and the climate crisis threaten and destroy mangroves? It's a resilient plant that breathes underwater. It can withstand the onslaught of cyclones and flooding. Well, like any living creature, mangroves can only withstand too much.
Whilst they tolerate sea inundation, they do need periods of time that are exposed to air.
Ruth Reif, a marine researcher at Monash University, says increased salinity levels and reduced sunlight creates a toxic cocktail for the plants. And it's this that has resulted in the decline of mangroves around the world.
It covers them only parts of the day, not fully. So when sea level rises, that time being inundated increases until it exceeds their tolerance.
But it's not just sea level rising that's threatening the existence of mangroves. Over-harvesting has been cited as a major factor, with villagers cutting down the resource to sell as firewood and medicine. She says the demand for firewood, along with financial desperation, has pushed many to plunder the plants. Dr. Rebecca Morris, senior lecturer in ecology at Melbourne University, says over-harvesting has been a major contributor. She says the demand for firewood, along with financial desperation, has pushed many to plunder the plants.
I mean, these coastal hazards have an impact on the communities and the infrastructure that lives next to the coast, but it can equally have an impact on our coastal ecosystems as well. They are our natural coastal protection service.
That was Dr. Rebecca Morris, senior lecturer in ecology at the University of Melbourne.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Have you heard of the new film, Papa Buka? It's made history as Papua New Guinea's first ever submission to the Academy Awards, competing in the Best International Feature Film category at the 98th Oscars. Let's have a quick listen.
This is the graveyard of soldiers who died in Papua New Guinea during World War II. 3,824 Commonwealth soldiers are buried here. 250 in the British Army are believed to be from India.
Set against the backdrop of World War II, the film follows two Indian historians as they journey through PNG to meet Papa Buka, an elderly war veteran who recounts untold stories of Indian soldiers who fought in PNG. Joining me now to chat about this is Parul Agrawal, executive producer of Papa Buka. Parul, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat this morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Look, I guess just firstly, congratulations. How did you feel when you found out that Papa Buka had become PNG's first submission to the Oscars?
Exactly. You know, it's an overwhelming feeling of pride, not for myself only, actually for the entire cast and crew and everyone who supported us along this way. This is actually collective victory, and I'm honored to share with each and everybody with us.
Oh, I can only imagine. Now, this story, it's an interesting one. It honors Indian soldiers who fought during the Second World War in PNG.
It's not Indian soldiers only. It's Indian and PNG soldiers.
Oh, right.
Who fought World War II.
Interesting. Well, yeah, I mean, either way, it's certainly an overlooked chapter in its history. Well, can you tell us about these soldiers and who they were?
Soldiers, actually, they are, if we talk about, because on that time, they fought, PNG and Indian soldiers fought, and their name not, their stories are untold. And which I think it's through Papa Buka, we will able to tell the world that their stories should be heard. They, from the World War II, PNG and Indian soldiers, they fought. So at least they should be heard.
Yeah, interesting. And in terms of sort of where these soldiers served during the war, did we see them at any, you know, famous battles like Milne Bay or Kokoda? I mean, what kind of things did they do?
Yeah, they fought. It's a Kokoda forest, and Madon here.
They
did. It's a trek. Yeah, it's a in PNG. You can see their sign here.
Yeah, excellent. And how did you ensure that their stories were told authentically and respectfully?
Yeah, this is that sign can be seen in the history. Yeah, it's everything is there. But we will say it's a drama feature film.
Yes, excellent.
So
give us an idea of the plot point. Who does it center around and what's the film about?
Actually, you know, if we talk about Papa Bukka, it's basically the main idea of the film is to tell untold story from the both PNG and Indian soldiers who sacrificed their lives during World War II, which almost forgotten. Here the main lead character, Papa Bukka, and who helped those historians, they come from the India, so who helped them to figure out, like to find out the where their science, and who tell the story about them, okay, like this is the that happened on that time, because that Papa Bukka main character fought on that World War II. He was a part of that journey.
Oh, wow. So Papa Bukka, he was a real person or at least based on a real person?
Exactly. He's the main lead character who fought there in World War II there.
Yeah, excellent. Now, as Papua New Guinea's first ever Oscar submission, how did the idea for this Indo-PNG co-production emerge, and what were the driving motivations behind bringing this story to the world stage?
Yeah, actually, definitely, I believe Papa Bukka stood out because it's tell a deep local story with universal truth. So this will definitely bring people, bring the new filmmaker to the chance to show their talent.
And
it will definitely.
Sorry, continue with what you were saying.
Yeah, that was I was just saying that. Papa Bukka will become a turning point, okay, that for telling Papua New Guinea, because PNG has not recognized till now in the world story. So it's a first time for the PNG to show on the Oscar stage, okay, that we are there, we are visible, and people can hear a story from our side too. And authenticity, we talk about the authenticity. Everything has been done evolved on their sites. Like we have used for the for shooting Vare Rata Forest.
Uh-huh.
Shooting has been done there. And PAU is a Pacific University here. All shooting has been, it's an authenticity. It's not inside the studio shooting. Everything mm-hmm. has been done on the location.
Oh,
whatever
wow.
you see in whatever you see in the movie, it's authenticity. Like all places, even the museum, they are like some scenes you will see in the movie. It's a museum. Everything is the authenticity there. Whatever filming there, it's their places. It's not it's a set.
Yeah.
It's a everything has been done on the their shooting place.
I'm with you. So
location we have location in the PNG.
A truly original production. No big studios. No blue scenes. Just
no
fully
studio,
on set.
No studio. Yeah. Yeah, no studio has been used. The shooting has been done on the location only. Whatever you see in the places.
Now, I know the film coincides with PNG's 50th year of independence. Was this timing deliberate?
No. Actually, if we talk about the timing, the release of Papa Boca during this PNG's 50th anniversary is a like beautiful coincidence only. See, but it wasn't originally planned for this milestone. It's a release aligned perfectly with the 50th anniversary. So we will say this film is a gift to our nation's golden jubilee year.
Now, can you talk about, I guess, some of the key challenges and achievements of bringing together a filmmaker's cast and crew?
Key challenges? Yeah, definitely. Definitely, we had faced some key challenges there. Some challenges we definitely face, like we talk about logistic. Actually, shooting in remote area was not easy. It's because here even the safety problems sometimes we face, and other things like transporting equipments from one place to another, and especially in unpredictable weather. If we talk about Koyari, Sugeri, rain can happen anytime there, you know, like it's a so that was a big challenge for us. So transporting equipment from one place to another. Second challenge, working with limited budget. You know, like budget we had limited and resources, but because only Indian crew, 10 people, they came from India. And more than 500 PNG, they participated in the movie.
And I understand.
Keep going. Yeah, for them, like, it's a new role. It's a first time they participate. Still, I will appreciate, like, we must say how talented PNG are. In a one time, how did they great job?
Well, I saw by watching the trailer, it was probably the most linguistically diverse trailer I'd ever watched. There was obviously English, Tok Pisin, there was Hindi, Bengali. How did you manage all those different languages during production?
Exactly. No, this is the, what I feel, language is a powerful reflection of the identity. And in Papa Boca, if we see, like, multiple languages has been used. Like Tok Pisin is it's a PNG national language, and Hindi and Bengali. So Hindi and Bengali, like it, that the speciality, I think I will say from Papa Boca, it's for honor the significant Indian soldiers and diaspora, because you will see in the movie like Indian diaspora, some scenes are there. So just for respect them, they will be speaking Hindi and Bengali, and actress itself is a Bengali actor. So she will be using Bengali dialogue in the movie too.
I see.
The English, English, like, it's a common language. It serves a bridge between, like, this Asian, Indian, and PNG.
Now, let's talk about its overarching impact for a second, because it's a history-making film in the sense that, you know, it's got a it's been submitted for the Academy Awards. What do you hope Papa Boca will achieve for PNG's film industry and just for local communities involved and audiences around the world in general?
Definitely. I will say Papa Boca Journey to the Oscar, it's not just about a film. It's about the recognition of PNG's potential in the global film industry. This achievement opens door for the future filmmakers from PNG to dream big and reach new heights. Definitely.
Absolutely. And when will you find out if your submission has been successful?
Submission, actually, I would say each and everyone, everybody who were in the who were connected in the Papa Boca, even though I will definitely convey my thanks to the PNG community who helped us in each and every way.
Yes. No, but so, when do you hear from the Academy, from the Oscars, as to whether or not the film has been accepted?
So that was accepted, I think, 2 weeks ago, which I'm not sure. Our producer is working on that.
Excellent. And if it's given a nomination, will you fly to America or Los Angeles in March when the Oscars are held?
Yeah, this is already nominated to St. Lucas.
Oh, fantastic.
So already confirmed. We got confirmation from there.
Perfect.
So that our movie is already in run.
So you'll be heading over for it?
Till now, it's still not decided. Let's see. First, we are just cherishing over this moment. Okay, just enjoying that our movie is going to Oscar. Let's see. No idea what happened.
Oh, well, whether you watch it live or at home on the couch, look, it's still an incredible achievement. Parul, that's all we've got time for today, but I just want to thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat and congratulate you again on your submission of Papa Buka.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you for being me there.
Not a problem at all. That was Parul Aragwal, executive producer of Papa Buka, speaking with us there.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, staying in the world of cinema for a moment, a documentary shedding light on the notorious Act of Free Choice referendum in West Papua nearly 60 years ago has aired in Fiji. Entitled Papera 1969, a Democratic Integration, it was screened at the University of the South Pacific. The film follows Bernard Aori, one of around 1,000 West Papuan voters who claimed they were coerced into taking part in a poll that was later labelled as a sham. Finau Fanua has been talking to Victor Mumbor, a West Papuan journalist and activist who helped to produce the documentary.
There's a story of a guy when they run the Papera in West Papua. He was in a senior high school. He told us in the documentary what happened with him during the Act of Free Choice running in West Papua. How he treat as a person who goes to election. He still when they took him to go to the election, he was in the field, football field, playing the football. He doesn't know what he have no idea what he will do for.
And this Act of Free Choice, could you explain to our audience what was the Act of Free Choice in 1969? What was the significance
of
this?
It's like a referendum. It's run by United Nations to West Papua people choose whether they be on part of Indonesia or they will be separated, will be independence.
And what was the controversy behind this referendum?
I know, and as I understand, that should be one people, one choice. But it's not run like that. It's not like that. They took only less than about 1,000 to went to the station for the footers, for the footing, for the foot. But actually, in the regulation in the United Nations regulation that they produce for the referendum for the Act of Free Choice, it should be one person, one choice, one man, one vote.
How important is it to make movies like this and showcase it around the world?
So the story is important, for not only for us in West Papua, but I think they put important thing that the young people, good people in West Papua, they need to know the true story. The young generation, Generation X, Gen Z.
You're one of the founders of Jubi Papua. This is a well-known news agency that covers what's going on in West Papua. And you actually, you were targeted as a journalist. Is that true? Is it dangerous being someone who is investigating things and showcasing what's happening in West Papua?
You know, West Papua is like a black hole. Even journalists, international journalists from upper world, they cannot enter West Papua. This is my responsibility to bring out the story in West Papua to the world. Because I'm West Papuan, then this is my responsibility, whatever the risk. Yes, I got many threats, but in the first time, I getting afraid. But now, I think it's like whatever that I need to facing on. So I need to take the risk because it's, this is about my people, but this is about my land.
Last question. What's your opinion on the current state of affairs in West Papua? Do you see progress in West Papua? Is it more challenging for the people of West Papua? We've seen a lot of violence over the last 2 years. What's your perspective?
I think now it's a hard time for West Papua because West Papua was divided into six provinces and a lot of troops come to our land and many killing, many arrested in the remote area and more people come to West Papua. I think the situation getting worse now.
That was Victor Mumbaugh, promoter for West Papuan documentary Prepara 1969, A Democratic Integration, and co-founder of Jubi Media Papua. Meanwhile, Fiji's film industry is also making a comeback with Bati, the country's first major feature film in two decades. The film tells the story of a retired soldier navigating life and relationships after returning home and has already made history as the first Fijian film to be selected for the New Zealand International Film Festival. Reporter Lithe Mavono spoke to director Andrew Ponton, who not only wrote the film but also took on multiple roles behind the scenes, to talk about the journey of bringing Bati to life.
In the local boxing scene, Alvin Ali has a new opponent lined up for the Bati boxing tournament. His original opponent has been removed from the competition following his arrest last Friday.
We've been looking for a replacement, but nobody wants to fight this gunshot notice.
Want me to replace him?
No, you're not ready.
It's been a lifelong dream of mine to make a feature film. And I grew up in Suva, so for me, it was a dream to try and make a feature film set in Suva. While I was growing up in Suva, I always wanted to see a film set in Fiji, set in Suva with Fijian characters in the lead roles. And so when I was at a point in my life where I felt like making a feature film, I knew that I had to set it here and to use Fijian characters in the main roles. So the idea, it's a boxing movie. Bati is a boxing movie set in Fiji. It's set in Suva and Namosi. And the idea came from me trying to make a film within my means. So a lot of the time there are film ideas that are just outside of your means. They're just too expensive to make. And I got really frustrated with trying to come up with film ideas that were just beyond my means. And so I try to think of a film that could be filmed with a small cast and a small crew and set mainly in one location. And for me, a boxing movie with just two characters, and for me, that was the right way to go.
So the film Bati tells the story of Sam, a security guard and aspiring boxer, and it's set between Suva and Namosi. Can you tell me about the significance of the storyline and these characters and also the locations that you've chosen to feature?
Well, Suva was easy because this is where I grew up, and so it felt very comfortable for me to make a story set in Suva. But the Namosi was different. When I was making the movie, one of the ideas of the movie is to have this juxtaposition between the city life and the village life. And so we tried to show Suva to represent the city life and the city world. And then we were looking for a village in Fiji that had traditional burres and traditional thatch roof burres and try to really capture that old traditional feeling of the olden time burres and the olden time villages. And we looked everywhere and we found a spot in Namosi that had those things. And so it was just about contacting them and asking if we could have permission to film there. And so that's why we chose to set the village scenes in Namosi.
Andrew, you wrote, directed, and produced Bati yourself. Can you tell me about the biggest challenges in bringing this film to life independently without a big studio behind you?
It was incredibly difficult to make this movie with no funding, no proper funding. And it's the biggest challenges was having to start from scratch and to not have any networks, not have any film networks. And there was no crew, there was no cast, there was no locations. And so it was a matter of trying to build those relationships and to build those networks in a short amount of time. And so it was looking for the crew, looking for the cast, and then doing work to look for the shooting locations. And then at the same time, scheduling a production and just eventually getting the job, you know, done, like going out there and filming it. And even while we were filming, there were lots of different problems that come about. And so it's just a matter of solving those problems on the day with a cast and crew that are dedicated to solving those problems.
In the end, what were the strengths, I guess? What were the things that helped you get across those challenges and brought the film to life now?
Perseverance. It's just a matter of there's lots of times where you feel like giving up. You feel like just not doing it. You feel like maybe doing something completely different. But for me, I felt like I had to make a feature film. It's just, it was just something in me I had to make. And I could feel that in the people that we were working with, like the actors. They had dreamed of becoming actors since they were kids. And I felt that passion in them. And so that motivated me to keep going. And also the director of photography, like he talks about films in a way that I could tell that he really wanted to make a feature film in Fiji as well. And so it was just this big passion project between all of us, and their enthusiasm for the project drove me to keep going. And little by little, just, you know, year by year, we progressed it bit by bit until eventually it got made. The movie took 8 years to get made, from me starting to write the script to delivering the film and watching it in the cinema.
8 years. Wow. And you managed to get it premiered at the New Zealand International Film Festival. And I've read that it's also the first Fijian film to feature there. How significant was that for you to be able to be the one that took the first Fijian film to the festival? But also, how important do you think this is for Fiji's own filmmaking industry?
First of all, I'd like to say it was a big honor to be part of the Whanau Marama New Zealand International Film Festival. It was an opportunity for us to showcase Fijian filmmaking and Fijian acting and Fijian film producing on a stage that was very international. Like there's a lot of it's a pretty big festival, this New Zealand International Film Festival. And they don't only host it in one city like many other festivals. They actually go on tour around New Zealand. So they show the film in many different locations, which was great. And I hope that we also managed to get our lead actor to go and attend the premiere in Auckland. And he had a really great time over there in Auckland, and he was networking and meeting other filmmakers there. And I hope this could be a starting point for New Zealand independent filmmaking and Fijian independent filmmaking to hopefully work together.
That was the director of Batty, Andrew Ponton, Fiji's first major film in 2 decades. And Andrew was speaking there to Lithe Mavono. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. Recapping our top story, there's debt fears in Vanuatu as a massive Chinese-funded road building program enters its third phase on the island of Tanna.
It stated quite clearly in the 2025 budget that if it was upgraded to high risk of debt distress, that it wouldn't take on any more debt, even concessional debt, and it would rely just on grant financing for projects. So last year, it was upgraded to high risk of debt distress, but this loan has still gone ahead.
Yeah, concerning stuff indeed. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. That'll be with Richard Hewitt. Stay tuned though on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. You'll find all our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine or via the ABC Pacific page, which is www.abc.net.au/Pacific. There you can listen to Pacific Beat Live or catch up on full Pacific Beat programs and individual segments. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.